Fifth and final class on the topic of conscription, and so welcome back to everybody. And I thought I'd start with a little historical background about military conscription in the United States. And one of the earliest examples of military conscription was during the Whiskey Rebellion. And this was in the early Republic. This was when Alexander Hamilton was the Treasury Secretary, and George Washington was the president. And there were farmers in western Pennsylvania who were protesting a special tax on whiskey. They had decided that it would be more economical for them to grow their grain and then turn the grain into booze and sell the booze rather than ship the grain all the way across the state of Pennsylvania or wherever to the market. And so they were protesting because there was a special tax on them and not on farmers who raised cotton or tobacco or rice or anything else. They're whiskey. And so Alexander Hamilton persuaded George Washington to teach them a lesson. And what they did was they got governors from along the eastern seaboard to conscript about 15,000 men to ride with Hamilton himself and George Washington into western Pennsylvania in order to put down the Whiskey Rebellion. And that's one of the first examples that I know of in the U.S. anyway, of military conscription. And it was an especially rotten deal because all the officers who rode herd over the conscripts were mostly government bondholders, according to the book on Hamilton and Jefferson by Claude Bower. It's called Hamilton and Jefferson. And so you had government bondholders who were anxious about this tax protest because they wanted to make sure there was enough money in the U.S. Treasury that they would have the principal and interest paid off on their bonds. They are appointed as officers to ride herd over 15,000 conscripts, and the conscripts were meant to rough up and intimidate the tax protesters. And they ended up rounding up a couple of dozen of the leaders of the tax protest movement, making them walk across the state of Pennsylvania, some of them in bare feet in the wintertime, put them on trial with Alexander Hamilton himself being the judge, jury, and he wanted to be executioner, but George Washington pardoned all of them. And so, but this was one of the first examples that I know of conscription, and the purpose of it was tax collection. And the historians mostly lie about it. They tell the story in such a way as to say that, well, this proved that the government had the power to tax and was willing to put force behind it. But in the end, they failed. The Whiskey Rebellion succeeded. George Washington pardoned everybody. And then when Jefferson was elected, he ended the whiskey tax. And so typically, the historians lie about it. The second historical example that's of prominence is military conscription during the American Civil War. And there's a very good old book on this, and it's by, the author is Ella Lawn, E-L-L-A, Ella as in Ella Fitzgerald, and the last name is Lawn, L-O-N-N, and it's called Desertion During the Civil War. And it was first published in 1928. But it's been reprinted, and you can order it on Amazon now, I did a couple of years ago. And she based her book on the official records of the War of the Rebellion, which is the source, supposedly, of primary source information on the American Civil War. It's all the records from all the generals and the other officers of the battles and who was there, how many people were there, and so forth. And so the conscription law came in, and it was in effect in 1863, in January of 1863, and that's why, by the way, there were draft riots in New York City and elsewhere. And there's a good book on the New York City draft riots called The New York City Draft Riots, and by Ivor Bernstein. I think I mentioned it in another class when someone brought up the draft. And so as soon as we had the draft, the government started enforcing the draft in New York City and elsewhere, and the draft protesters rioted. There was a week-long riot. Abe Lincoln sent some 15,000 troops from the recently concluded Battle of Gettysburg, to march into New York City and shoot into the crowds, killing hundreds of people. No one seems to know exactly how many were killed. Bernstein says around 700 to 1,000, but other people think that the government soldiers carried the bodies off pretty quickly so that no one would know what they did in New York City. And so that one did succeed. They didn't force the draft, but as a result of that, and of other tactics like that, there were hundreds of thousands of runaway slaves. And I'm not talking about slaves, the African slaves. I'm talking about draftees who were made into slaves by being conscripted. And there turned out to be literally hundreds of thousands of deserters in the U.S. Army during the Civil War. And Ella Lawn documents all of this. And so this is many orders of magnitude larger than the runaway slaves that are so famous from the so-called Underground Railroad. You know, the so-called Underground Railroad was a relatively small group of people who smuggled runaway slaves out of the southern states, before slavery ended. And it ended up in Canada because of the Fugitive Slave Act. There was a bounty on the head of any runaway slave. So if he popped up in Pennsylvania or someplace like that, or Wisconsin or Massachusetts, he could be sent back to a slave plantation. But even so, there were only a couple of thousand slaves who participated in the Underground Railroad. But the slaves who were made military slaves in the military by the conscription law in the Lincoln administration, there were hundreds of thousands of them. Not 2,000, but hundreds of thousands. And it's all documented by Ella Lawn. For example, she, based on official records of the U.S. government, she said that some 200,000 Northern men, one out of seven in the entire U.S. Army, deserted. 200,000. And in addition to that, Professor Clyde Wilson estimated that there were also about 200,000 European mercenaries who fought in Lincoln's army, as well as the 200,000, hundreds of thousands of conscripts. And 200,000 at least deserted. And based on the records, here's what Ella Lawn says about the deserters. She said, although General McClellan had 180,000 men on his official roster prior to the Battle of Antietam, he had no more than 90,000 during the battle itself. So about half of McClellan's army deserted on the eve of battle. He says, General Sherman reported 70,000 men missing during the Battle of Shiloh. Missing, deserted, 70,000. And she goes on to write that in June of 1862, this was even before conscription, General Buell reported from Tennessee that 14,000 officers and soldiers were absent from his command. And then General Halleck wrote to Lincoln, he said that hundreds of officers were almost continually absent from their commands, and about 200 more were absent without leave every month. And so according to the official records, there were about 100,000 deserters from the Union Army in the year 1862 alone. And so even before the conscription law came into effect, maybe perhaps in anticipation of it, there was massive desertion during the war by the U.S. Army. Okay, and so here's what Ella Lawn writes about the conscription law. So once the conscription law was passed and enforced, draftees were held like veritable prisoners so as to prevent their untimely departure. So they literally were slaves, and I would argue that military conscription in a lot of cases is far worse than slavery, because if you're killed in a war in which you are forced to participate, that's certainly even worse than being a slave. At least a slave can always hope to escape, but there's no escaping death. And so she goes on to say that the Lincoln government said they had, quote, had no compunctions about shooting or hanging deserters who resisted arrest. And so these people were enslaved by military conscription, and if they were runaways, they didn't do what they did with the runaway African slaves. The runaway African slaves would be brought before a magistrate in a non-slave state, and the magistrate was paid $10 if he decided to return the slave to his owner, and $5 if he decided to free the slave. That's how they dealt with the runaway African slaves. But the runaway military slaves during the Lincoln administration were shot, killed. there was no trial, no due process, rounded up and shut. And Ella Wand describes from the government's own records how this went about, how the shooting of deserters went about. It had sort of Nazi-like efficiency. She says this, I'm quoting her, "A gallows and shooting ground were provided in each corps, and scarcely a Friday passed during the winter of 1863-1864 that some wretched deserter did not suffer the death penalty in the Army of the Potomac. And moreover, the death penalty was so unsparingly used that executions were almost daily occurrences in most of the armies." Okay, so that's how it went down. And then she describes how the executions took place based on the government's own descriptions of them. And she says this, "The condemned men marched out between the two ranks of the regiment, preceded by the musicians playing a funeral march. Provost guard as an escort carried the coffin. The victim was conducted to the edge of the grave, which had already been dug. After the sentence was read, he was seated, blindfolded, and placed upon a board at the foot of the open coffin into which he fell backwards when the firing squad had discharged its sad duty. The method of execution was generally shooting, but hanging seems to have been used occasionally also." So that was a daily occurrence in Lincoln's army. And that's the origins of American conscription. And one of the things that Robert Higgs says about this in the article that I put on the syllabus for tonight, he says, if it's acceptable to enslave men in the military, then it is acceptable to violate any and all individual rights. If it is acceptable for the government to enslave you and send you to your death and shoot you or hang you dead if you object, well, then it can do anything to you or anybody else. In fact, the government will use the excuse that, well, your fellow citizens are being drafted and conscripted and sent into war. The least you can do is abandon your civil liberties here at home. And they have always made that argument. They've always made that argument. The South also had conscription also. I see a question there about that, but that's irrelevant to what I'm having to say here. I'm talking about the U.S. government policy of conscription. My discussion of the Civil War is not a sporting event. It's not either you're for the South or you're for the North. We're interested in understanding historical truth here. And so what the South had conscription is just as bad as anywhere else. Although there wasn't as much desertion, according to Ella Wand in the South. So if it is acceptable to enslave men in the military, then it is acceptable to violate any and all rights. And they did. During World War I, for example, the Espionage Act had contained 20-year prison sentences for interfering in conscription. And interfering with conscription could simply be being caught disagreeing with the war. Voicing disapproval of American entry into the war, criticizing how the war was being executed by the U.S. government. That would be discouraging conscription. There was pervasive censorship of the mail, the radio, communication, telegraph, everything during World War I, and it was all justified by, if we can conscript men into the military, then we can do anything with regard to liberty. Upton Sinclair, the famous author, was arrested for publicly reading the Bill of Rights. There was a man named Roger Baldwin who was arrested in New Jersey for publicly reading the Constitution. And people were lynched by mobs for expressing disloyalty or opposing the war. That was World War I. And of course, in the American Civil War, once you can conscript or enslave men into the army and shoot them if they deserve it, you can do anything. So that's not surprising then that the Lincoln administration also thought it had the right to destroy over 300 opposition newspapers, to suspend the writ of habeas corpus, imprison some 15,000 war dissent critics, deport a member of Congress, intimidate the federal judiciary by threatening to imprison them if they issued opinions that the Lincoln administration didn't like, confiscating firearms in the border states in violation of the Second Amendment. They could do anything. There were no civil liberties in the United States government during during the Civil War. And that really set the template for some of the worst abuses that we've ever seen in the United States anyway, as far as abolition of civil liberties goes. And so in World War II, the draft was used as an excuse to adopt central planning and a lot of other things. You know, if we could draft men and plan our way through the war, then it was used to adopt central planning of the economy, which I've talked about a couple of weeks ago. It was also used to justify the Japanese internment. If we can draft men into the army, they said, and send them to fight in this awful war, well then surely it's not too offensive to round up all the Japanese Americans and put them in concentration camps. That's the argument that was made. Conscientious objectors were imprisoned. There was mass censorship of newspapers, seizures of hundreds of industries, and there were some 4,300 FBI agents hired to spy on Americans. And so this was all justified by the draft. And of course, all during the Cold War, the thousands and thousands of Americans were spied on by the FBI and others because, as I said, anything goes. And this was sort of the theme of the neoconservatives after 9/11. Their mantra was 9/11 changes everything, by which they meant suspend the Constitution. And they did their best to do that. So the draft has always been very instrumental in breaking down whatever constitutional barriers there have been to the growth of government. It's kind of a subtle thing, but it's very real and it's very important, I think, that the draft has always been seen this way. As an excuse, a general overall excuse to abolish liberty. And the article that I put on the reading list by Milton Friedman, like much of what Friedman has to say, is very, very well thought out, where he makes the case for the volunteer army. And there was a famous incident, it's written up in a few places on the web, I'm not sure there's any minutes of this meeting, but Milton Friedman was on a committee during the Vietnam War that Richard Nixon appointed him to, along with the commanding general of the U.S. Army in Vietnam, Westmoreland. And the commission was to look into the volunteer army. And so you had Milton Friedman, the economist, sitting there next to the general. And the story goes that Milton is making his case for a volunteer army and getting rid of the draft. And Westmoreland turned to him and said, well, why would we want a mercenary army? And the story goes that Friedman's response was that, well, General, I have a mercenary lawyer and a mercenary doctor, and I shop at a mercenary grocery store, and I buy my cars from a mercenary auto dealers. A mercenary just means somebody who gets paid to do something. And what's wrong with that? And besides that, why is a slave army such a good idea? And reportedly, the general threw a fit over that one. But Friedman eventually did get his way. They did end the draft and adopt the volunteer army. And Friedman's article is really a classic statement of some of the arguments in favor of a volunteer army. If you're going to have an army, hopefully it's a defensive army. If you're going to have an army, it's better to have one that's volunteer, is the argument that he made. And he was a pretty creative thinker on this. I always, even as a college student, I always admired how good Milton Friedman was in articulating economic ideas to the general public. And one of the comments that he made was that, one of the reasons, I think later in his life he made this comment, that one of the reasons why we see so many entrepreneurs among the generation that became adults after the war, after the Vietnam War, and after the early 70s, people like Bill Gates, who founded Microsoft in the late 70s, early 80s, was that this whole generation of young people no longer had this war and military conscription and the worry of military conscription hanging over their heads. They could apply themselves to whatever they wanted to apply themselves to, rather than trying to finagle their way out of the draft and do it in all sorts of different ways. And we can't prove that, but it's an intriguing idea that ending the draft actually led to a spurt of entrepreneurship in the business sector, because people who would have been sort of languishing away for years in the military as conscripts or slaves would have been becoming entrepreneurs instead, some of them. Anyway, that's Friedman's argument. And so so that's the story. And the case for the volunteer army is there are many advantages of it that Friedman points out. You know, if you have people who choose the military as a career rather than people who don't want to do it, you have lower turnover. And like any business, of course, does not like high turnover. They have to spend money to retrain people. And so the military will be better off, Friedman argues, with lower turnover, presumably with people wanting military careers. So of course, that depends on the kinds of wars you have, too. Now, the current wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, they've sort of turned into conscription, because a lot of the soldiers who signed up for one tour of duty have been told, sorry, you're coming back for another tour. Some of you might remember that a month or two ago, there was this news reports of a slaughter of a dozen or so people in Afghanistan by an American soldier. You know, whether it was him or groups of American soldiers, it's likely that what the news report said was that this is a guy who wanted to come home, and he'd been there for several tours of duty already, and they said, no, you're staying there. And so he supposedly kind of lost it over this. Whether that's true, I don't know. That's what all the news reports say, but it sounds perfectly feasible to me. And so you wouldn't have that sort of thing. They probably have a higher skill level among people in the military, because if you're a slave, you're a slave. You have no incentive to acquire additional skills, because you cannot personally benefit from acquiring additional skills. But if that's your career, and the way to get promoted and make more money and higher rank and all that is to acquire skills, well, then you'll acquire skills. The average person will. And so that's another point that Friedman makes. And of course, he makes the libertarian argument, too, that it preserves the freedom to join or not join, freedom of association. You can associate with the military if you want, or you cannot associate with the military. And also, during periods of conscription, draft-age men were not permitted to travel abroad. And so with the volunteer army, any 20-year-old or 19-year-old can go to a foreign country and not be restricted, because the government might need to enslave him at any moment. And another point that Friedman made was that there's no arbitrary discrimination, or at least much less arbitrary discrimination, because merit becomes much more important under a volunteer army as a way to progress. But there was all sorts of discrimination from the very beginning with conscription. In the Civil War, for example, you could buy your way out of the conscription with $300. And so if you were wealthy enough to come up with $300, which was about the annual salary of a New York City dock worker at the time, well, then you wouldn't have to go to draft. Or if you could find a replacement, pay somebody to take your place, you could avoid the draft. During the Vietnam War, you could get out of the draft for a while anyway if you were married, or if you were enrolled as a college student. They got rid of those deferments, as they were called, eventually. But you had many thousands of young men getting married when they shouldn't have, just to escape the draft. And of course, a lot of those marriages were rotten marriages that ended in divorce, because they weren't getting married for the right reasons. They were getting married just to avoid the draft, as far as that goes. And so you wouldn't have as much of that type of arbitrary discrimination whoever has the strongest lobbying power to get special rules made for them. Let's see, I just noticed one question here. The author's name that I talked to earlier is Lon, L-O-N-N, not Long, but Lon, L-O-N-N, L-O-N. And so you wouldn't have that. You wouldn't have arbitrary discrimination. Another advantage of volunteer army is that the young people can plan their careers. Even if they want to join the army for a couple of years, they can plan. They can say, well, I'm going to go to college after 2 years in the army, and then go on, graduate, get a job, start a business, raise a family. But conscription interrupts all that. You're a slave, and you do what the government wants you to do. Another aspect of the draft was that while there were, especially while there was a deferment for college students, you had many tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of college-age people going to college, not because they wanted to go to college, but to stay out of the war in Vietnam. My own brother did that. In fact, my own brother even got married to avoid the draft. And so and there were hundreds of thousands like that in that era. And so you would no longer have that. And so the colleges would no longer be dumping grounds for people just wanting to avoid the draft. And another part, a particularly economic-oriented point that Friedman makes, is that the pay would be better for the soldiers because you'd have to do what any business would do and offer people decent money to come to do the job. And so rather than, I think during Friedman's time when he was writing this article, maybe in around 1970, around there, I think soldiers are paid $45 a week, something like that. You know, even adjusting for inflation, that in today's money, that's not that much. And so you couldn't buy too much. And so the military would have to compete. And of course, when it does that, it sort of sucks labor out of the private sector. So there is of course, an opportunity cost of that. When more and more people working for the government in the military, it dries up the labor pool available for real businesses, private sector businesses. That's one of the downsides of that. But these are most of the essential points that Friedman makes about the volunteer army. And they apparently were very persuasive in this committee that was appointed by President Richard Nixon because they did eventually get rid of the draft. And it ended, I believe, in 73. I think it was 1973, along with the Vietnam War. And Friedman was very instrumental in that. And so to the extent that he was, he did more good than whatever, however much money he made in his lifetime as a Nobel Prize winning economist. He was undercompensated if he did really have an important role in persuading Nixon and the Congress to go along with ending the draft. And so there's always also been a movement, not always, but for a long, long time, for a civilian draft. I think this was especially, I think there have been books written about this in the early 20th century, making various arguments for a civilian draft. And this is another bad consequence of the military draft. The argument is often made that, well, some young people, if they're drafted in the military, you had people like the late William F. Buckley Jr. saying, I learned a lot of good things in the military, it helped me grow up, I became more mature, and everything, all these things. And wouldn't it be nice if every young American could have a similar experience, maybe not with the military, but you know, draft them to empty bedpans at a hospice or something like that. Have them do some dirty work that no one else wants to do. That's one of the themes of the advocates of what they call national service, to draft 18-year-olds to do all the dirty work for minuscule wages, by the way, that no one else wants to do. And so, and they call it, sometimes they call it service and voluntary service. In the state of Maryland, for example, they've had it for about, I don't know, about 12 or 13 years now at least, what they call voluntary service for high school students to perform, I think it's 75 hours of service. But the service is determined for you by the government. And you cannot graduate, from high school unless you perform a public high school, unless you perform the service that the government tells you to perform. And so, unless you don't have enough money to go to private school, and your parent is forced to send kids to public school, you're forced into it to begin with. They're a captured audience, and then the politicians use them as political pawns, forcing them to do work for their favorite organization, sometimes a political organization, or else they won't get their college or their high school diploma. And that's called voluntary service. It's not very voluntary. And besides that, if it's tax financed, which it is, taxes are not voluntary. So the whole enterprise cannot possibly be deemed voluntary if it's paid for by taxes. And there are a number of states that do this also. Maryland is not the only one. And as I said, there's been a big movement about this. Ayn Rand wrote about this in one of her books. I think it was one of the essays in Capitalism, The Unknown Ideal, a book by Ayn Rand. where she touches upon this. And I might be mistaken about that, but that's where I think I read it a long time ago. And she made the point that the whole idea behind national service, or sort of a universal conscription for military and non-military government programs, is that if you pursue your life, you go to school, you get a job, you start a business, you raise a family, that's not important. What's important is being a sacrificial lamb for the state. Now that is service. That's good. And of course, that's exactly right. That's the argument that is made. And in the university world today, for example, students are constantly being harassed and harangued to perform some sort of voluntary service, which is nothing objectionable about donating your services to a charity or a soup kitchen or something like that, or tutoring. It's all good things, if you want to volunteer your time to do that. But in doing this, universities often miseducate the students, because they lead them to believe that the only way to provide a service to your fellow human beings is to be a volunteer, to donate your time, to sacrifice. But of course, no business can succeed without providing a service to its customers. It has to serve its customers in order to succeed. And that point is missed by a lot of these students it's drilled into their head day in and day out that if you're not a good person unless you volunteer and make a sacrifice and serve other people. Well, every business that is successful does that. And that's a point that I often make in my classrooms. And I'm sort of a skunk at the garden party in the university world for saying things like that. An argument that is often made in favor of national service is that it creates a sense of community. And sense of community, well, it pretty much indoctrinates people into becoming worshippers of the state, too. Because the so-called service is usually some sort of government program, and you're paid by the government also. So you learn how to milk the taxpayer. That's the sense of community. The community of plunderers is what you're becoming a part of, for the most part. And a lot of it just turns into a political patronage scam. Surprise, surprise. In Maryland, an example I gave earlier, in Maryland, the organizer, the creator of the program in Maryland was Kathleen Kennedy Townsend, who was Ted Kennedy's niece. She was lieutenant governor some years ago, and this was her program that she got put in place. And I can remember reading in the newspaper the day after she got elected, along with Paris Glendening, who was the governor at the time. The next day, the front page of the Baltimore Sun said that the first thing they did the day after the election was to stop off at a county public school and thank the students there for donating their service time for working on their campaign. And so these students, the legislature had already was in the process of passing this law, and so they already had service programs. And so they forced these kids to go to the public school if their parents could not afford private school, and then they essentially forced them into working for their campaign, which could involve nothing more than going around town and pulling out the signs advertising vote for Paris Glendening's opponent. I think who at the time was a woman named Ellen Sauerbrey, and she lost the election by about 6,000 votes, as I recall. So the so-called national service can turn into a political patronage scam. I wrote an article about this in The Freeman many years ago. It was in the early 90s. I think it was called National Service, then some subtitle. If you go to fee.org, I'm sure you can find it. I think it was called subtitle something like a solution in search of a problem or something like that. And one of the things I pointed out in this article, this old article on so-called national service, which was being talked about a lot by a lot of prominent people then, including William F. Buckley Jr., as I mentioned earlier, was that this had a funny ring to me, this whole business of conscripting youth into serving the state in some way. So I went to the library and picked up a whole bunch of books on Nazi Germany that had something to say about the Hitler Youth. And the Hitler Youth was created by something in Germany called, and I quote, the Law for National Labor Service. So they call it the National Labor Service. But in the United States, its advocates call it National Service. They just leave the labor out of it. And so, and I quoted in my article, I quoted some of the things that the Germans of the 1920s and 30s were saying about the glories of the Hitler Youth. And it was very similar to what William F. Buckley Jr. and other proponents of compulsory national service in the 1990s were saying. It's pretty much the same idea. And I'm not saying Buckley was a Nazi or sympathized with the Nazis, but it's a totalitarian idea. And of course, Buckley was of the opinion that to fight the Cold War, he once said that we needed a totalitarian bureaucracy within our shores. And so he favored not only military conscription, but non-military conscription, and that would include, you know, a big FBI, a big military-industrial complex, a big spying network, a big CIA apparatus. Buckley was always in favor of all those things. And he was the original modern neoconservative as a result of that. And of course, he was in favor of this version of the Hitler Youth called National Service. He wrote a whole book about it before he died, making the case for civilian national service. I see one of our Cracker Jack researchers got my Freeman article online already. Carlos. Good work, Carlos. And so, so those are the arguments that Friedman made for against the draft, and the things I just said were some of the arguments that I made in opposition to a civilian draft. But you still see this from time to time being talked about, the civilian draft. And I think probably the most important point of this whole discussion is the point that Robert Higgs makes in this article that I put on the syllabus for tonight, that that if a government can do this, if it can work its way into drafting people and sending them off to die and be maimed in a war, then it can do anything to you. It can tax away your wealth, it can put you in prison for speaking freely, and it has. And governments have done these things. And so so this is really a shock therapy, the military conscription, to let the people know that you're slaves. You work for the state, and we can do what we want with you. And we don't have a draft now, but in the United States, it's still necessary, it's still illegal to not sign up for the draft. And so young people are still supposed to sign up for the draft just in case the government ever wants to bring it back. And I heard the economist Walter Williams talking about this once in a speech he gave at my university, at my invitation, several years ago, and he said it's sort of like if the government were to say, well, we're ending slavery, no more slavery, the 13th Amendment is passed in 1866, it became effective, but to all the ex-slaves, we want you to sign up anyway, you know, give us your name and address, you know, let us know where we can find you. Wouldn't the former slaves feel a little worried about that? So that's how Walter Williams put this idea that we're going to get rid of the draft, but we want to know where you are, so sign up and give us your address, your phone number, and everything else, so we know where to find you. And so they always keep it in their back pocket, as far as that's concerned. And so and those are the basic points I wanted to make, I think, for tonight on the politics and economics of military conscription and a little bit of history of military conscription. And of course, the only way to enforce something like that is by shooting deserters. There's actually a scandal about, a bit of an academic scandal about the Lincoln administration. There was a book written several years ago that claimed that Lincoln pardoned all the deserters, and it turns out to be fraudulent, and the researcher was embarrassed, of course, and he shouldn't have any credibility at all. But now we know by reading Ella Lawn's book and others that there were very few pardons. The U.S. government really heavily enforced military conscription by killing deserters on a daily basis, by its own admission. And all governments have done that. And so I guess that's all I wanted to say for tonight. It's about 8:10, and I'll look and see what kind of wise comments we have here from the students. And I'll answer any questions that you have if I can. Patrick Weeks says after he signed up for the draft, Gillette found out about it and sent him a free razor. Yeah, that's a reason to sign up. And here's a question from, Q&A there. I lost my question. What happened here? I lost the chat somehow. I got Q&A but no chat. I think the question was about, I started to read. I don't know why I can't get the chat on here anymore. The question I started to read was about the funding of World War II and that Higgs mentioned in his article. And so, the thing about the Fed is the Fed has never been audited fully, and so we have no idea how much the monetization of the war debt went on. The government will print some statistics, and Robert Higgs cites the government statistics of 10% of World War II being funded by the monetization of the debt by the Fed, but I don't really believe them. So here's the thing right here. I see it. I'm back in the chat. But you can't believe it. You know, just recently when we found out, you know, it was only after a lawsuit by Bloomberg that we found out that the Fed had been bailing out European central banks, not just American businesses, but European and Lord knows who else around the world. And so if they're hiding these things from us, I don't really trust those statistics on how much debt monetization there has been, because I suspect a lot of what the Fed does is to work hand in hand with the CIA in giving the CIA money for its activities. And so and the government will always say it's classified information, we can't tell you. These are some of the questions Ron Paul would like to ask someday if they were given a chance. So I don't think we have reliable statistics on this. Was the draft's constitutionality ever challenged in court? I'm not familiar with any serious challenges that might have run up to the Supreme Court or anything like this. There might have been some lawsuits, but since we had the draft during the Civil War, that established the precedent. And the government tends to always take the argument that if we did something and we got away with it, that establishes a new power. Alexander Hamilton actually made the argument he invented the idea of implied powers of the Constitution, and he also tried to present the idea of resultant powers. And his argument was that if the government did something that was clearly not among the delegated powers of the Constitution, and it did it, and it's a fait accompli, it's done, well, that establishes a precedent of creating a new delegated power, he said. So if the government runs afoul of the Constitution and gets away with it, that's a new power all of a sudden. And so that was Hamilton's argument, a very subversive argument, very dishonest argument. So that's where we are now. I think that's the way the government approaches these things, if they establish a precedent. And then, of course, they lionize and deify the people who established these precedents, like Father Abraham, as they refer to Lincoln. And so anyone who challenges them on this, they'll be portrayed as somebody who's attacking God himself. Having written two books critical of Abe Lincoln, I'm totally convinced that I would have had less criticism had I written two books criticizing Jesus Christ than Abe Lincoln. Let's see. there's Cam Ray, what's known, any good books or articles concerning the mercenaries. Yeah, there's a book called Melting Pot Soldiers about European immigrants who came, recent immigrants who fought mostly in the Union Army in the American Civil War. And I think there's some websites online. I think Professor Clyde Wilson, I heard him do a presentation on it once. If you really want to do research on it, you just email Clyde Wilson. You can find him on, find his email on some of his LouRockwell.com articles. But I once heard him give a public presentation on this, and he has a lot of statistics, and he would know where to find it. But I recall the book Melting Pot Soldiers has some information on the mercenaries. Wilson thinks it's around 200,000. I cited some of them this in my history of Lincoln too. If I could possibly dig this up before too long. There's a book called The Hard Hand of War about the waging of total war on Southern civilians by the Lincoln administration. And the author does mention how a lot of the jails in Europe were emptied out, where the Lincoln administration offered to put a lot of the prisoners from European jails into his army and pay them. And so, of course, the European governments thought this was a great idea because they got rid of the worst people in their societies and got them off their hands, emptied out their jails. And these were a lot of the soldiers who were put into Sherman's army, Sherman's March. And let's see if I can find this in a minute. Not too much searching around. I know it's The Hard Hand of War, the name of the book. And I'm sure somebody can find it. And Mark Grimsley is the author, Grimsley. The Hard Hand of War, Union Military Policy Towards Southern Civilians. And so, and it does talk about European mercenaries there also. If I can find, I'm looking at this now, I'm going to find a quote from him. Yeah, there's a biographer of Sherman also named Lee Kennett, K-E-N-N-E-T-T, and in his biography of General Sherman, he says this, about the New York regiments were filled with big city criminals and foreigners fresh from the jails of the old world, end quote. And so Lee Kennett also writes about this phenomenon of the Lincoln administration hiring criminals from the European jails to be part of its army. Okay, let me see what if there's anything in the Q&A here as opposed to the chat. In the chat, Greg Ward thinks the nullification movement is really starting to take off. I hope so. that's good. Any more chats? Any more chats here? Any more book requests? Let's see, any other toppers here? And by the way, as a little advertisement, the Mises Institute's 30th anniversary dinner is going to be next September, the end of September. You can go to Mises.org and find information about it. And it's going to be Callaway Gardens, Georgia. But the theme of the conference, the two-day conference, is the truth about war. So it ought to be a pretty good event as far as that goes. The talk that I gave them just yesterday, a title for my talk, is going to be the myth of the pro-war constitutionalist. I'm going to talk about people like Mark Levin, who claim to be champions of the Constitution, while at the same time defending all the evisceration of the Constitution during wartime, at least when their people, the Republican Party, is in charge of the war. And so, but there'll be, we usually have 20 or 25 speakers at these things, the big October conference. This one this year is late September, I believe. I know it's October. It is October. And so so if you're all interested in this whole general topic, it's the truth about war. And so keep in touch with Mises.org, and you'll see more and more about it in the coming months. Any other questions? Brilliant announcements? Anything like that? Okay, well, if not, like I said, we can wrap it up. And if anyone wants to take a quiz, I'll be glad to make one up. And if you can get a, you know, if you can take it, and so you can get a grade for the course. And I hope you all learned a thing or two about the political economy of war. It's a real interesting topic to me, as you know. And thanks a lot for attending. And I had a good time, as always. And have a good night, I guess, we're all done with questions.